I'm here in Belturbet and I'm talking to Brendan McCann.
Brendan McCann, yeah.
Brendan, it's lovely being here with you and talking to you about your life. And tell me exactly, where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in this area, in Belturbet, just outside the town, about a mile or so, in a place called Kilconny, really a part of the town, always. And my people came from Fermanagh. An interesting thing, my family were Fermanagh people on my father's side, and they lived on the border, virtually on the border river, which came in with partition, was the Mearn Drain or the Mearn River for their farm.
What was the name of the town's land?
And this, the name of the town land was Drumecha, County Fermanagh. And it became the border stream. The river below the house became the border stream. One morning when they looked out, the river was no longer a mere river. It's called the Woodford. It was now a border. And that was the beginning of, if you like, the division between the north and the south, because that hinterland was all part of this town. But Herbert was a thriving town way back in the 1920s and at the turn of the century. In fact, there were three banks in this town at one time, a huge market town, wonderfully successful place. But as I say, its hinterland was quite a bit ways into the north, down as far as Derry Lynn. And it was a thriving place. Now, that's my father's side. My mother came from County Leitrim, and my mother was a teacher who died young, and my father, of course, died young too. And we lived outside Belturbet in a place called, as I said, Kilconny. And my father and mother died, and the family broke up. And my brothers went to America. My sisters went to school, and I went to work in Dublin. But I began work, believe it or not, when I was 13, because my father, who was still alive just before that time, said to me, you know, you want me to become an apprentice to learn something. So I became a grocer's boy. Anyway, he died shortly after that, and I remained on in this grocery business and the hardware business. And eventually, the people who took over the estate of the family and dealing with the matters of winding it up sent me to Dublin. They were wonderful people, my aunt and uncle, Fonzie Smith and Hailish, my aunt. Great people to my family.
And did you grow up in the Church of Ireland?
No, we were Catholic. Yeah.
Oh, you're Catholic.
Catholic. Oh, yeah, Roman Catholic. Yeah. So my mother was as I said, she died when I was 12. My father when I was 15 or so. I wasn't quite 16. And I was the oldest of the family. And it was quite a breakup. You can imagine when that happened. But anyway, I went to Dublin. But while I was in Belturbet, I worked for this 3 years in this grocery business. And halfway through my term there, it was sold to another businessman, a very successful businessman from Ballyconnell, called Mr. Richardson. And I was transferred to the hardware department.
So became the name of the store?
The store was Richardson's, but before that it was Woodhouse's. There would be both Church of Ireland. The Church of Ireland presence in Belturbet, this was a garrison town in the old days, way back. It began in 1610, it was founded. I'm sure you'll find all the details on that. And so that garrison tradition was quite strong in the town. And there was, in fact, a battalion of soldiers in the town up until 1920, and they vacated with the Act of Partition or the Treaty or the Truce or whatever you call it, and they left Belturbet at that point, and the border became, as I said, a reality.
Do you remember the time living at home with your father? The border was so close to to you.
Yeah.
How did it affect your family?
Yeah, well, the border was a mile down
your
the road.
Father and mother.
It was a mile down. It affected my father more than my mother because he, after all, was a Fermanagh who lived just across the border, and he had settled just on this side of the border when he married my mother. So, and he would come from the nationalist republican tradition on the Catholic side in the north. And he was quite you know, active politically. He was supported Sean McBride in the clan, the public, the party. So there would have been a strong political tradition in the house, and we would be politically aware, so to speak, of all the political factors, north and south. So we would have been very conscious of the border, and the border was a real smuggler's haven at that time. And I can remember acts of smuggling and smuggler stuff coming in into our house from the north, and certain things were cheaper. And I was a war child, 1940, so I just have a glimpses and memories of the war being on and the impact that the border had, and how sometimes it was used during the war years for getting stuff that was otherwise not available.
So that border, did it indicate a different country when you travelled north to Ireland?
No, I never accepted that it was a different country. You know, I mean, I hate that phrase used sometimes by northern people. I think it's provocational, really, about another country. You know, and it's disappointing to hear it being used, but. No, we never saw it that way. It was just another province, if you like, or another area of division, you know, and an unfortunate breach, you know, in our country. But the river down the road, the Woodford, didn't, you know, set up another country across the bridge. It just was another county in Ireland, and was still a strong allegiance to the north, Fermanagh with us, of course, being my father's home place, and also, for example, with the GAA, it was very strongly present in the north as a nationalist factor. You know.
Now you grew up in the 40s and 50s, and so. You must have been quite aware of the unrest approaching the outbreak of the Troubles and Bloody Sunday. Where were you in Bloody Sunday?
Where was I on Bloody Sunday? I know, that's a good question. I think I was in. I think I may have been in America on Bloody Sunday. I'm not sure about that now, but I think I was. I was in Dublin at that time. I went off to become a student and eventually got a degree. And after I got my degree, and the summer of that degree was 68, I went to America for a few months. And I mean, if I remember, the Bloody Sunday was 68, wasn't it?
69.
Was it 69? Yeah. It was 69. Well, maybe it was 69 that I was in America again. I'm not sure, but I was. It doesn't strike me. I can't remember it powerfully. Now, at the moment, but at the time, of course, it struck me very forcibly, and we were all very disturbed about it. But where I was, I can't recall now.
That's okay. And so, as soon as the civil rights marches and the Troubles began, did you start to feel in any way afraid, or did you want to?
Well, it set up a great, very difficult, complex reaction, certainly for me, you know. There was the obvious threat to the nationalist people in the north by the dominance of the Unionist Party and the failure of the John Hume's civil rights movement. I think it was one of the great shames of the north that John Hume's attempt to, you know, achieve basic civil rights could not have been achieved without the ensuing debacle that emerged from the refusal to do that. We had the closing of Stormont, and we had the 30 years of Troubles. And I always say, if John Hume had to be given his civil rights, we would have been spared the bomb, the bullet, and the broken hearts. But that wasn't done, you see. And the struggle, as you see, after 30 out of 40 years, eventually they got the Anglo-Irish Agreement, but it was something that was slowly, you know, excruciatingly slowly developed through negotiations and counter problems, so, and all the difficulties associated with debate and discussion and negotiation, and George Mitchell's endless patience and trying to get constructive ambiguity to work. You know, it's all very sad, really, in the end.
And what happened to the family home when your parents died?
Oh, well, the family home was eventually sold. It was rented off for a long time, but we vacated it. And
where did you continue to live yourself?
I went off to Dublin then.
Yeah, and did you spend your working life in Dublin?
I became a barman in Dublin for years. Then I became a bus conductor.
Yeah.
Then I became a night telephonist, and then I became something else. You know, but I got myself through university. I was lucky. I just got into university before free education emerged. Just at that point, where the great Donald O'Malley made his wonderful contribution, largely forgotten now, sadly. And from there on, I had a career then in teaching. So I was.
Where did you teach?
I taught briefly I remember my first bits of teaching was around Dublin and Mount Street. I remember teaching. There was a school there but my full time job was in Cavan, and eventually I taught with the Loretto Order in Loretto College Cavan for the most of my life.
In Cavan Town,
which is about 10 miles up the road.
And what year did you join the Loretto Order?
About 1969-70, around there.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So, my goodness, so you had quite an interesting life leading up to that in going a bus conductor and teaching in Dublin and then your travels abroad. So you had a quite...
My brothers went to America, I didn't say that. They went to America, and those are the guys I went out to see in 1968 or 69.
Yeah.
They were very good to me. They frequently invite me out for visits, you know, to the States. They're there now, 50, 60 years now. It was kind of forced emigration after the death of my parents, and they went off. And my sisters, as I say, were happily educated by my very good friends in Malterba Alfonsi and Baby Smith. And they got a good education, and they went off to develop their own professions then.
So when this bomb exploded here in the village, this was your town, really, wasn't it?
1972, Christmas 1972.
How did it affect you?
Oh, well, it affected me a little bit because I was back. I had qualified as a teacher and was back now working in Cavan, and I was living locally, and I was actually living in Enniskillen, believe it or not, and because I married a girl who was working
Did you travel up and down all
yes,
the time?
Yes, I did, over the border.
Did you? Yeah. Every day?
Yes, right. And so,
through the Troubles?
Through a portion of the Troubles.
Yeah.
I was come up, for example, I remember the morning I came up and the border bridge was gone.
Yeah.
And I drove up and there was a big hole in the road where the bridge was, and there was a sign saying bomb, and I said, oh, man, I have to get back, so I had to go back and find an alternative route. Of course, then the road was closed off then by the army and police immediately.
Yeah.
But I was going up too early to school, that the road hadn't been sealed off, so I was able to drive up and see this hole in them. But that was the beginning, and that bridge, the Ahalane Bridge, which was a main artery into Enniskillen, was closed for 30 odd years.
Imagine, yes. And so that affected your travel.
Yes, and I found an alternative route to get up from Enniskillen to my work in Cavan.
And did you suffer any harassment going through the border each time?
Well, you would be checked, of course you would be checked.
And did they get to know you?
No. Well, see, the army would be very impersonal, you know. So then there was army posts built, and they would just go through. You got familiar with procedures, you know.
Yeah.
The army were more, if you like, cursory, whereas the police, who would know whether you were Catholic or Protestant immediately by looking at you, as we know in this northern area here, they would probably be a little bit more investigative of your car.
Describe that to me. How would they know you?
Oh, absolutely. No question. No question about that.
In what way now?
Well, I'm not going to go into that. But we do. They know. I mean, we do. I remember a friend telling me one time he had a Protestant name, you see, and he was working in the north, and he thought he was being, you know, incognito. Nobody knew him.
Yeah.
And his Protestant friends were working with him, and everything was very, very, very relaxed and everything else. And so one day his friend made a remark to the effect that he understood that he was the other side. And he says, "How did you know?" He says, "That I was the other side." So he says, "I can see the Pope dancing in your eyes," he says. So anyway, that
it hadn't anything to do with the what about the registration of your car?
That would be they wouldn't need to know the registration of my car, but it helps because in fact when I drove a northern car, you see, that when I was down there, that was another little incident where I had, because when I was going up and down, I was driving a southern car for a while, and then the customs became very active and said, look, you've got to get rid of that car. So I had to acquire a northern car while I was temporary resident in the north.
Yeah.
While I was living in the north, an interesting thing happened. My wife was a radiographer, a senior radiographer, and got a very good job there in Enniskillen.
What was her name?
Her name was Brenda McCann, and Brenda McKenna was her maiden name.
She's still with...
Still with me, thanks be to God. Great woman. Yeah. But she had a great job there. In fact, she gave it up to her children. But that's another story. But when I was there, we were living in a flat in Enniskillen. And one day I came home from school and the police were on the road and said, you can't cross the bridge to your flat. There's a bomb threat on the barracks, on the income tax office. I said, my wife lives across the road from the income tax office. Honor says, everybody's been cleared out. He says, we've checked all the houses. He says, but we're not letting you cross. But I said, I'd like to cross and check. I said, just to be sure, you know. No, he said, you can't cross. And I remember I walked down to the bridge and didn't I see my wife actually walking out the door of the house up the street, evidently getting away. So I was relieved. But minutes later, the whole place blew up. And the income tax office, of course, was wrecked. But equally wrecked was our flat on the far side of the road. So and when I returned, there was nothing, only blown out windows and rubbish all over the place and ceilings falling in and all kinds of damage. So we had to find a temporary residence in Enniskillen for a small time. And then I was building a house here in this Belturbet area. And so shortly after that, when I finished the house, we moved permanently to live in the Belturbet area, away from Enniskillen, but the troubles were still going on.
I see. And what year did that
happen?
That'd
be about 1973, 74, I think we came.
So, yeah, I mean, but all those days of hearing in the news and even experiencing firsthand, as you did that become part of the day, part of... became the norm in
a sense? Well, you were very well versed being a border person. I always think the border consciousness is different, you know, to the southern consciousness or even the northern consciousness.
And again, how do
I think
you
it's to do with the fact that we're caught between two zones, if you like. You know, there's a kind of. So we have this kind of intermediary, dimension which we bring to the context in our thinking. We have that, you know, we can move from one side to the other, and we have a better understanding, I think, of that tension which is there, you know.
Oh, do you? Because that's a very interesting point, you know, that you would have this almost feeling that, you know, you're neither here nor there, like you're in the middle.
Well, you would be conscious.
But
of
you're
that.
Very much Irish, is that?
Oh, we're all Irish. I mean, I think this notion of this distinction being made about British and Irish, I have no problem whatever about, you know, our northern brethren having their British identity and all. That's fine with me, you know. But the notion that they're not Irish, I find that objectionable. You know, that we're all Irish. Okay, if you have a twin identity or a twin relationship with Britain, that's fine with me. Or America, that's fine with me. Or wherever you come from, fine with me. You know? But you're here in Ireland, and, you know, I think that... But at the same time, I think there is a kind of... even in the northern people, there is that kind of...
Yeah.
If you like, endemic Irishness, no matter which side they're on.
And so when you were teaching then in Cavan, because you were privy to school children's thoughts and feelings on all of this, did you sense that at that particular time that there was a dislike or even stronger word, hatred towards what was happening in the north, you know, with you know, the troubles in the north.
Yeah, well, there was a fear, and there was a terrible reluctance to get involved, and there was a hesitance about comment, and, you know, there was various kinds, the strands of politics, for example. You'd have the Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin, political, SDLP, political, extreme IRA, you know, would be military and all. So you have all the strands operating, and you didn't know where they crossed into each other, or where they were, if you like, influencing each other. So those people were very careful, very, very, very selective about what they'd say and about how they would commit themselves. So there was, if you like, a kind of reluctance to become, if you like, identified too strongly with any position. So people became, if you like, reserved.
And was there a tendency to influence maybe within teaching and that?
No, that was an area. It really didn't affect the teaching at all. You never would make a political point when you're teaching.
What were you teaching?
I was teaching English mainly and history, believe it or not, and geography and various other subjects at the beginning of my career. But in the end, I specialised in English and history.
Yeah. And did you specialise in any particular part of history? Was it?
Well, I was covering the, you know, European and Irish history was the leading cert course at the time, you know. So, but I mean, I had very good students, but I would always train them to think. I said, there are so many different, you know, agendas in history. I said, and one of the historian's obligations is to recognize that everyone writes from an agenda. Which agenda is he writing from or she writing from? And to recognize that, and also to recognize that we ourselves, I'm speaking to you now from an agenda.
Yes.
I'm not free of agenda.
Okay.
Everyone who speaks has a will, if you like, betray their agenda.
Yeah.
Some people try to suggest an objectivity and, you know, a kind of formality and indifference to others. But they are the real dangerous people, because they are pushing their agenda very surreptitiously through the narrative. But other people are quite frank about their agenda. Others are a great deal more subtle. But
I
nonetheless,
see.
And that's what I was. That would be one of the themes I would have used in my history teaching, to teach them to recognize, for example, the way European history was written by the victors, you know, and all that, and the crisis in Germany, for example, in Versailles, you know, that sort of stuff. You only get the one side of white.
Yeah.
So I would be training them to think for themselves, ideally to emerge with this capacity to recognize the agendas at work, and maybe to recognize that their own was the kind of position that needs to be criticized too, like my position has to be criticized.
Were you ever, did you ever question the fact that, you know, history stopped after 1916, just at that point?
Yeah,
no contemporary Irish history being taught.
It was not. But now they have men corrected all that. Now there's modern histories. But there was a reluctance to teach it because of the Civil War, you see, and that division between, and I was reared on that diet of the Civil War division between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, between, you know, the extreme Republican position and the political position, and I inherited all those strands in my thinking as a young person. And you had to make up your mind, you know, whether you were going to be a constitutional nationalist or a radical Republican, or you know, or a conservative, you know, who wasn't taking any sides, you know, going around respectively indifferent, supposedly, to what that was going on.
did that influence you?
It would have influenced me, yes, no question. Would have modified my consciousness, to use the phrase.
And so you were saying your wife was a radiographer in Enniskillen. Now were you in Enniskillen, or was she in Enniskillen when the bomb there went off? The bomb in Enniskillen.
No, we weren't there for that. No, we had long left the town when the Enniskillen bomb went off. Yeah,
was that there were so many people killed.
Yes, and it was a dreadful business, you know. And I mean, it cast a terrible cloud, and it was also, terrible that it happened. And we were, you know, ashamed of it and all that sort of stuff. But you had to be careful because, you see, the other side was going to use it as a propaganda, you know, yeah. heavily, and it's still being used as a propaganda, you know, the different travesties like Oma and Skillen, and, you know, and there was another one, I can't say, but they were being used as examples of this terrible terrorist terror yeah. that was going on, while the other agenda was not getting the treatment at all. And this was my great objection to the North, was all these agendas competing, and whoever controlled the media controlled the agenda. So I mean I was never, if you like, deluded by the popularity of certain propaganda which was being used, because people controlled the methods of communication, and you were getting heavily one-sided approach. Yeah. Very intelligently presented and brilliantly and articulately delivered and very convincingly, you know, set forth. But it's all part of a thesis that they were advancing. Whereas the other side, for all their faults and failings and wrongdoings and whatever, they were not getting the same kind of treatment, you see, kind of, if you like, public or
well,
media.
Well, that's an
treatment.
Interesting point, mm. because when you turn on your radio, you know, you hear the news at the time.
Yes, you hear the news now. You look at whatever you're listening to, it's all coming from some agenda. And I said, that's going back to my students, that's the best you can do is to be aware that they're speaking from a point of view. And they're trying to convince you, or assuming that you share their point of view, that you're in sympathy with their point of view, where you might be very critical of it or have reservations about it.
I see, yeah. And you know, when you cross over, because I mean, you're the obvious person to ask this question, but when you cross over from one side to the other mm-hmm. of the border, what are the differences? What do you see different?
Well, there's a nuance of reservation. I can put it that way, you know, when you go into the shops, or you be aware of it, just of a slight alteration in, you know, the communication. You know, there's a kind of wariness there somewhere. You know, it has been, if you like, severely dented by, you know, the knock-on effects of the troubles. People were thrown together and forced to negotiate and communicate and relate to each other, and they were equally bombed and equally injured by these horrors, you know?
Yeah.
So that there was a kind of a common sharing of this travesty that was happening, you know?
Yeah.
So that maybe there was a kind of a development of a mutual understanding, kind of a strange bonus from the horror, you know, that people would say, well, they're suffering just like us, you know, and that there was then a kind of communication developing, you know.
Yes.
And then when they did eventually communicate, they began to say, maybe we can, you know, Paisley and McGuinness, you know, getting on together, you know. How did that happen after all the horrors that were going on beforehand? And they found that when people met each other and talked to each other, and shared their agendas, if you like, you know, they began to say, well, hold on here, let's see, can we reach some accommodations, you know. Nobody has to surrender their position, but if they can reach. But it's a very difficult thing to reach accommodations. George Mitchell, I think, was a genius, to reach accommodations between immovable forces, you know. That was the Good Friday Agreement.
And then after the Good Friday Agreement, you saw less presence of military on the
road. There was a wonderful release there, almost a palpable evacuation of stress and terror. You know, I felt that, even myself. And you couldn't imagine that these things were disappearing. These gun posts were gone, you know. And you were driving across the border and nobody was stopping you or coming out of the hedges in this, you know, military uniform or, you know, combat uniform. None of that happening, and the relief was great, but it took a few years for the psychology to adapt to this kind of new...
Trusting the facts,
yeah,
I suppose.
This is actually real. That's why we're a little concerned about Brexit at the moment, that it might, you know, upset the whole thing and revert back to to another time. We don't want to go there again.
Of course, and that physical awareness, as you say, of the road changes, the road signage,
Lane Bridge was repaired, yes, for example, eventually, yeah, after, yeah, 20, 30 years, and it's called the George Mitchell Bridge, by the way. It's an interesting thing. George has already come down and opened the bridge himself, of course. So that was a great symbol, the bridge, yeah, being reopened, and the traffic, the N3 running right through to Enniskillen and on then to Ballyshannon, you know,
yeah,
and Donegal. So it was an important thing. And then all the other bridges that were blown up, and there was, as you know, I'm sure you're aware of all the books with all the bridges blown up, they were all eventually repaired.
Yeah.
And then these, if you like, these conduits of contact were re-established, and the normality began to be restored.
And that George Mitchell Bridge, when it was repaired, were you there? Did you travel?
Oh, I did.
To the opening?
Oh, yes. I think I can't remember. We were all at the opening, I think, but it was full of important people, you know. So, yeah, you know, the general public were slightly removed. Well, we might have been there, but I can't recall whether I was there. But certainly, I was enthusiastic about it. But it was a very public occasion when a lot of.
But that symbolic, just, you know, yeah, it was opening, and it was now,
yeah,
free to travel.
That's free, and a great, great bridge. You know, well built, and clearly with an intent that it wasn't something temporary, or, you know, it was, yeah, really. So, but they, you began to be aware, I was aware anyway, of the significance of bridges, you know,
yes,
and how, if you like, how precarious they are, bridges, and they can be damaged,
yeah,
and you know, it's like the synapse in the mind jumping when things cross. You need to be able to get across, you know,
exactly,
to make the experience work. And the same with bridges. When these contacts are severed, certain, you know, sociological factors are affected by it.
Yes, yes, of course, because they represent a barrier, don't
they?
They
do, yeah, they do.
And,
yeah, and they constitute an inconvenience because you have to go through another way.
Yeah.
And that other way is usually with armed police or armed army, you know, checking you through. And it's all, yeah, very difficult. Sometimes there's big, long queues that you have to get through, you know.
Yeah.
I remember writing a poem about it somewhere called Checkpoint, you know.
Can you recall it?
Oh, I can't recall it, no. But, I mean, I have a poem on it. But, you know, that was the alternative world, if you like.
Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah. I'd be very interested in seeing that piece of poetry sometime that,
yeah,
you wrote about Checkpoint.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But the no, it's fascinating to hear how somebody who had to travel back and forth all the time, and what you yourself, how you imagined the border to be.
But the real borders are the borders of the mind, because, I mean, for me, when Bloody Sunday happened, I mean, it was a terrible moment, you know, when the answer to John Hume's appeal for civil rights was Bloody Sunday, instead of giving the man his few paltry civil rights and stopping the whole thing in its tracks. We had Bloody Sunday, and then we had all the things that happened thereafter. Then that set up in the mind of many nationalist-minded people, and I would come from a nationalist tradition. Where were you going to stand when this happened? You know, were you going to stand political? Were you to become more militant? It was a very difficult time.
Yeah.
For people who were, if you like, politically minded, or who were constitutionally minded, as I would be. It meant taking a stand, and some of your friends were more extreme in their positions, and you were inclined to say, "Well, I'm a constitutional nationalist." It wouldn't be a popular position, especially in moments of dread terror, like,
yeah,
especially in the time of the hunger strikes, for example, when, you know, when the nationalists seemed to be a cozy standing on the fence, you know, stepping out of the range of the severe, so to speak, you know, under the name of some kind of superior, respectable constitutionalism, you know, but being mocked by people like that too. So it's very hard to, when you're in that position, to maintain respectfully and convincingly and agreeably with people who are not of a different
But yes, but you are of a nationalist background.
Yes.
Your
sure.
father, your
yes.
father who
yes, my father would have been Republican. He would have fought. He would have been a Republican way back in the time of the foundation of the state.
How did you then respond to what the IRA were doing in the
yeah, well,
the
this was
troubles?
What I'm saying. They would represent that dimension of Irish history. And I mean, you have to make a decision.
What's the difference between the two?
Well, the difference is one is military and one is constitutional. You mean, are you going to opt for the constitutional process for the reunification of Ireland, which I have opted for, or are you going to go for a more militant, aggressive approach because all politics has failed, don't you see?
Yeah.
Someone might say to me, what are you doing politics? Your politics has failed. Look at what John Hume got for his politics. You know, he started, innocently started all this
yeah.
horror that lasted for 30 or 40 years. So you're wasting your time with politics because it doesn't work.
Are you suggesting so that the hard way...
No, I'm suggesting that the powerful argument of the hard way, you know,
yeah.
when it's put to you aggressively, you know, I'm still would be the constitutional nationalist, right?
Yes.
So but the constitutionalism has to get returns, and this is why George Mitchell has to be, you know, greatly praised, and John Hume, because the American dimension, which was very significant in developing the strands for the Good Friday Agreement, they have proved that nationalist processes or that constitutional processes can prevail.
Yes, and yeah. how do you feel now? I mean, would you shake hands with the UVF as quickly?
No,
as
I wouldn't.
As with
I wouldn't
IRA?
Shake hands. No, I wouldn't be. You know, I mean, the horrors there were horrific, and that's it. I mean, I'm not going to grand saying that somehow we can become. We can modify our positions towards these things. I mean, you're either for or against the violence, you know.
And, yeah.
But
violence is over.
Violence is over, and that's it.
And
but if people wish to, you know, to become more accommodating and more, you know, they go through processes, you know, the Christian process of, you know, you have to reconcile with people who have offended you, and maybe I've offended them. So this process of reconciliation, we must be careful that it's, you know,
handled in the right way.
Yes, right, and that it's vigorous and real and sensible.
Yeah,
and that it's not just decorative or, you know, sentimental.
Exactly.
You know, that it has to be real, and that's why I like sometimes the Northern Unionist. He's a very straightforward person who thinks straight, who tells you what it is, right? And they don't do ambiguity very good on their side. And the nationalists, of course, are not great at it either. But at the same time, they have to learn some kind of process of reconciliation and all these strands that are being tentatively put out now. There's a bit of a crisis going on, as you know, about
yeah.
that. So they're going to find some methods that will start to work by way of, if you like, reviving the conciliation process. And that's what's going on in the North, the conciliation process.
Brendan McCann, thank you very much. It was lovely, and thank you very much indeed. I appreciate that. That's fine.